If we work marble, it will perish. If we work upon brass, time will efface it. If we rear temples, they will crumble into dust. But if we work upon immortal minds and instill into them just principles, we are then engraving upon tablets which no time will efface, but will brighten and brighten to all eternity. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parashat Bo, Ra, Abu Simbel, and the Exodus. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Welcome to Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World. This series is brought to you by MeirSoloveitchik.com, a project of Tikva. If you'd like to learn more with Rabbi Soloveitchik, we invite you to subscribe at MeirSoloveitchik.com. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Aryeh Bach.
Ramesses II was, in a sense, the greatest builder in human history. But the buildings brought into being at his command existed not to further the well-being of his subjects, but rather to ensure his own immortality. The Egyptologist Toby Wilkinson informs us, quote, "Today, more standing monuments bear the names of Ramesses II than of any other pharaoh. By a combination of construction and appropriation, taking pains to have his cartouche incised so deeply into the stone that it could never be removed, Ramesses ensured that his name would live forever. He seems to have been driven by a deep desire to surpass all his predecessors and by a resolute sense of his own uniqueness," end quote. During the period of Ramesses' reign, two of his projects would have stood out as the most wondrous of all. The first was the creation of a new capital where his throne was located. Its name, of course, was linked to his own, inspiring our own interests as students of scripture. Wilkinson further writes, quote, "Not content with erecting temples and usurping monuments throughout the length and breadth of Egypt, Ramesses II created an architectural wonder on an even greater scale, one that is now entirely lost from sight. His father, Seti I, had built a small summer palace near the old Hyksos capital of Hutwaret, where the Ramesside royal family had its origins. The young Ramesses must have spent time there, preparing for battle, and as king, he set about transforming it into something altogether grander. In 2 decades of nonstop construction, a vast series of mansions, halls, offices, and barracks grew up around the royal palace, until Ramesses had created an entirely new city, a dynastic capital equal in splendor to Memphis or Thebes. With customary chutzpah, he named it Per Ramesses, the House of Ramesses," end quote. Per Ramesses, or P. Ramesses, the House of Ramesses, was once one of the most incredible cities on earth, and it is difficult to think of another example of a king creating a capital of similar significance for his own glorification alone. Babel existed before Nebuchadnezzar, as much as that king arrogantly associated himself with it. Ptolemy I created Alexandria, but named it after the man he once served. Ramesses built a new city to celebrate himself, named for himself. And if many associate Ramesses II with the pharaoh of the oppression at the beginning of the Book of Exodus, it is because the pharaoh who enslaves the Israelites seems to create a city with just this name. Wilkinson notes this as well, quote, Exodus 1:11 tells us how Pharaoh put the enslaved Hebrews to work on two great store cities, Pithom and Ramesses. Pithom, or Per Atum, has been identified as modern Tel El Mashuta in the eastern delta, only a day's journey from Per Ramesses, while Ramesses can be none other than the new dynastic capital itself, end quote. This would mean that the Israelites would have built the city known as the House of Ramesses, and that Goshen, where they lived, would have been in its vicinity. Historians describe the new capital as a sort of Venice in the desert. In her acclaimed biography, Ramesses, Egypt's Greatest Pharaoh, Joyce Tildesley describes its beauty, citing an ancient eyewitness. She writes, quote, "The new city of P. Ramesses, like the primeval mound, was surrounded by water. To the west and north flowed the Pelusiac branch of the Nile known as the Waters of Re, while to the south and east was an artificial canal, the Waters of Avaris, which fed a lake, the Waters of the Residence. Further south, a second lake allowed the development of a port within easy reach of both the eastern Mediterranean and southern Egypt. Thus, the city was provided not only with a source of drinking water, but also with a means of transport, sanitation, irrigation, and defense. Beyond the city, there was abundant fertile land with desert to the east. Everyone who came to P. Ramesses was impressed by its beauty and its abundance." And then Tildesley goes on to cite assorted sentences from a more ancient source, writing about P. Ramesses that, quote, "It is a beautiful place, which although resembling Thebes, has no equal. Life in the residence is good. The fields are filled with all kinds of good produce, so that each day is blessed with good food. Its canals teem with fish, and its marshland is filled with birds. From the fields come fruit flavored with honey. The granaries overflow with barley and wheat. End quote. So Tildesley writes, if then, the Pharaoh at the time of the Exodus was ruling from this city, we can well understand Pharaoh's growing shame as the plagues shattered the feeling of complacency and luxury within it. As the beautiful waters turned to blood, the abundant fish and animals died, and the grains were consumed. The Pharaoh's embarrassment would have been enhanced by the fact that the Israelites, in the nearby suburb of Goshen, seemed utterly immune from the plagues suffered by the Egyptians. But perhaps even grander than the capital of Paramesses was a creation that can still be seen today in southern Egypt at Abu Simbel, a temple whose Holy of Holies contained images of Egyptian gods and of Ramesses himself, and whose outer walls featured astonishing statues of the Egyptian king. What is most incredible, even today, about Abu Simbel is not its grandeur, but its joining of architecture and astronomy. For somehow, as can be seen to this day, the building was architecturally aligned in such a way so that twice a year, originally the 21st of October and February, the sunlight would enter the structure so that the rays would extend into the inner recesses of the building, and the statue of Ramesses and the images of the gods associated with the sun would glow. The suggestion has been made, and this will be important for our discussion, that these moments marked the periods of planting in late fall and harvesting in February. But it would seem that the dates may have been also selected for a connection to Ramesses, perhaps marking his birthday and anniversary of coronation. The incredible illumination, as Wilkinson reflects, was meant to reflect the very divinity of Pharaoh himself. Quote, in his mind and in his monuments, the king was the equal of Egypt's most ancient and revered deities. And Wilkinson concludes, it must have been a stunning spectacle. Few autocrats in human history have conceived a more dramatic expression of their personality cult. End quote. Thus, the glorification of Ramesses through the son of Abu Simbel was linked to the agricultural abundance of Egypt, supposedly reflecting the benevolence of the sun god upon Ramesses' dynasty. Understanding that the city built by the Israelites may have been known in Egypt as the House of Ramesses can reveal new insights in our reading, and the existence of Abu Simbel allows us to appreciate a possible pun in our parasha, which in turn reveals the Exodus to reflect a reversal of all that Egypt embodied. Let us see how this is so. Soon after the miraculous hailstorm discussed in last week's reading, Moses warns Pharaoh of another plague yet to come. He says, in the name of God, behold, I bring tomorrow locusts in your borders, and it will cover the face of the land so that the land cannot be seen, and it will devour the additional remnant left over after the hail. So Moses said, if, as many assume, Moses spoke to a member of the Ramesside dynasty, perhaps Ramesses' son Merneptah, then our knowledge of Egyptian architecture and ritual lends a distinct drama to his declamation. The solar quote-unquote miracle of Abu Simbel would have announced the harvest in February, with the barley crop destroyed almost immediately after by the plague of hail. Now, Moses is warning, the most important aspect of the Egyptian agrarian economy, its wheat, was at risk. Pharaoh almost relents, and then his heart is hardened again as he harshly proclaims the following. Ru'u ki ra'ah neged pinechem. See, there is ra'ah opposite your faces. Simply translated from the Hebrew, ra'ah means evil. For Pharaoh to say to Moses and Aaron that there is evil opposite your faces is to threaten them. But as Umberto Casuto comments, this may well be an allusion to Ra, or Re, the Egyptian sun god. Pharaoh, Casuto writes, is telling them that Ra stands against the god of the Hebrews in whose name Moses speaks, or as Casuto puts it, quote, the sense is, know that the power of my God will oppose you, end quote.
I hope you're enjoying this exploration of the Parsha's political wisdom. You can continue learning with Rabbi Soloveitchik at meirsoloveitchik.com, where you'll find a growing Torah library of online video courses, essays, and his two daily podcasts, Bible 365, a year-long study of the entire Tanakh, and Jerusalem 365, which explores the 4,000-year history of the Jewish people's eternal capital in a single year.
This comment by Casuto is striking. As he notes, it actually parallels a rabbinic midrash cited by Rashi. And there is much more to add to Casuto's point. For if this is a pharaoh from the Ramesside dynasty, then the pun is even more profound. Moses is threatening what remains of the harvest, whereas in Abu Simbel, the sunlight on the very face of Ramesses is what guarantees the abundance of the harvest itself. Saying that Ra is opposite your face may be a reference to this yearly cosmological phenomenon. The locusts, of course, come, and the harvest that the son of Abu Simbel would have announced is suddenly lost. And if the benevolence of the sun god seemed suddenly to have been challenged by Moses, the plague that comes next is especially striking. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand toward heaven that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt." As Casuto comments, this penultimate plague not only refutes Egyptian theology, it may be linked to the Pharaoh's very reference to the sun god. He writes, quote, "This plague will demonstrate how great is the Lord's power against the gods of Egypt. When the God of Israel wills it, the sun, which is regarded by the Egyptians as the chief deity, will be hidden and unable to shine upon its worshippers. And if the conjecture that the word Ra'a in verse 10 alludes to the Egyptian sun god be correct, the plague of darkness may be viewed as an immediate reaction to Pharaoh's remarks," end quote. This is fascinating, and when we bear Abu Simbel in mind, architecturally arranged so that the sun glows on Pharaoh's face, then the statement of the Pharaoh to Moses after the plague of darkness is quite striking. "And Pharaoh said unto him, Get away from me, take heed for yourself. See my face no more, for in that day you see my face, you shall die. And Moses said, You have spoken well. I will see your face again no more." Classical commentators struggle with this prediction, as Moses and Pharaoh would meet again before the Exodus. But the point, as many suggest, is that they would meet in the darkness of night before sunrise, during the plague of the firstborn, so that Pharaoh's face could not be clearly seen. And if we bear in mind how the sun and Abu Simbel would illumine the Pharaoh's face, then Moses' cutting comment is meant as an inversion and rejection of the entire cult of Pharaoh's worship that lay at the heart of Egyptian tyranny. If the plague of darkness was an assault on Egyptian theology, the Hebrews' preparation for the final plague would emphasize the heart of the Israelite faith. We must note one word that appears again and again. Here are several verses. "On the 10th day of the month, every man shall take a lamb for his father's house, a lamb for every home. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood and place it on the lintel and the sidepost, and none of you shall go out from the door of his home until the morning. And the blood shall be for you a sign on your homes." After spending centuries building palaces, temples, and cities for Pharaoh, the final moment before redemption would be spent inside the humble Israelite home, emphasizing that it is not through construction, but the household, the family, that Israelite identity is assured. Placing the blood on doorposts was not merely a sign of divine protection. Rather, as others have noted, it highlighted that the Israelite home was turning into a temple, a center of cultic rite and ritual, into a sacred site. Indeed, at this point, rather than describe the future of the Israelite polity, Moses, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks notes, speaks about parents and children, instructing Israel that this moment would be recreated and retold in the ceremony that would become the Seder. Moses says, "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, It is because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt." In this verse, Moses, as Rabbi Sacks notes, quote, "fixed his vision not on the immediate but on the distant future, and not on adults but children. In so doing, he was making a fundamental point. It may be hard to escape from tyranny, but it is harder still to build and sustain a free society," end quote. Thus the Seder, as Rabbi Sacks reflects, is a fitting response to Ramesses' approach to immortality, highlighting how education and transmission rather than construction is the essence of endurance. And if we imagine Moses speaking to slaves in the shadow of P. Ramesses, the most glorious city ever created by a king in his own name in the history of the world, then we can understand how the ritual of the Paschal Lamb might have been intended to express what Daniel Webster once said, quote, "Marble, it will perish. If we work upon brass, time will efface it. If we rear temples, they will crumble into dust. But if we work upon immortal minds and instill into them just principles, we are then engraving upon tablets which no time will efface, but will brighten and brighten to all eternity," end quote. Pharaoh's capital was called the House of Ramesses, and if it is there that the Pharaoh of the Exodus dwells, then as the plague of the firstborn descends, we can understand how this plague undermines the Egyptian ruler's purported power. As the verse puts it, "for there was no home in which there was no dead." If it is in Per-Ramesses that all this occurs, then as all the power Per-Ramesses proclaims is undone, as it is belied by the deaths of the Egyptian firstborn, the humble homes of the Israelite families are themselves turned into the true temples of Egypt, so that the simple structures in which parents and children live and learn are placed at the heart of Israelite culture and faith forever. Pharaoh, in desperation, orders the Israelites to leave, and the Hebrews depart from the city of Ramesses, traveling eastward to Sukkot. And another incredibly interesting detail about the capital allows us to suggest something new. Wilkinson tells us the following about Per-Ramesses, quote, "The four cardinal points of the city were placed under the symbolic protection of other major deities. In the south was the temple of Seth, lord of Hutwaret, dating back to Hyksos times. In the north, a shrine was built to honor the ancient cobra goddess of the delta, Wajet. In the west, a temple celebrated Amun of Thebes. Finally, in the east, pointing the way to Egypt's empire in the Near East, a sanctuary was dedicated to Astarte, not an Egyptian deity at all, but the Syrian goddess of love and war, appropriated into the Egyptian pantheon and given the special role of protecting the horse team that drew the royal chariot. End quote. Here, too, the symbolism of the city might allow us to understand how the plagues set the stage for the final inversion. A statue of a pagan goddess in Per-Ramesses pointed east toward Canaan, reflecting its purported protection of the Egyptian royal chariot. If this is where the Exodus is taking place, then, as the Israelites departed Per-Ramesses, they headed east toward Canaan, and they would have been pursued by chariots that relied on the assured protection of this goddess. And as we will read next week, this purported pagan power would also be disproved. If we work marble, it will perish. So Daniel Webster said. The capital name for Ramesses the Great disappeared with his dynasty, and the faith and texts of the Hebrew slaves was the main way in which it was remembered. Joyce Tildesley tells us, quote, "It seems almost inconceivable that such a splendid city could disappear without trace, but this is exactly what happened to Pi-Ramesses. Although the city outlived its founder, continuing in use throughout the 20th dynasty, its fate was sealed when the Pelusiac branch of the Nile started to silt up. Gradually, the Nile changed its course to flow further north, rendering the port of Pi-Ramesses useless and effectively isolating the city from the main highway of Egypt. Eventually, during the 21st dynasty, the decision was taken to abandon Pi-Ramesses and establish a royal city at nearby Tanis. Much of the old city was dismantled, its valuable masonry transported to Tanis for reuse. The mud brick buildings were simply abandoned and slowly subsided into mounds of fertile soil. With the passage of time, more modern buildings, fields, and irrigation canals obscured the archaeological site, until Pi-Ramesses was just a name preserved in the monuments of Ramesses and in the Bible." End quote. Abu Simbel, of course, remains, but the original Egyptian empire does not. It is therefore incredible to ponder an image of Menachem Begin after the Camp David Accords standing in front of Abu Simbel. To this day, the sun illumines the face of Ramesses twice a year, but as the poet Shelley famously put it, nothing beside remains. Meanwhile, a descendant of Hebrew slaves can stand in front of perhaps the most astonishing glorification of a tyrant ever created, doing so as the leader of a resurrected Jewish state, embodying the astonishing endurance of a people that left that land so many millennia ago. The humble home of the Israelites has defeated the house of Ramesses in a victory that resounds through the ages and contains lessons for us all. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together next week, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, signing off.